ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 22nd of December. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, in the wake of the Bondi shooting, pressure mounts on the Albanese government to call a royal commission into anti-Semitism. And the AI Balancing Act. How can educators juggle the potential for this powerful technology with the need to crack down on cheating?
This trial and error approach is absolutely unfair. It's unfair on the students who are being interrogated in these quite unfair ways. We do absolutely need to reset the way we're talking about this.
New South Wales Parliament has been recalled to debate new laws in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. Premier Chris Minns addressed the session, saying it's Parliament's responsibility to urgently address anti-Semitism.
I have to say, Mr. Speaker, I bear a deep responsibility for that as Premier. We must make those changes. When I say to the Jewish people of this state, this is your home. This has always been your home. And we must do everything we possibly can to ensure that you are safe and you are protected in this city.
It follows a national day of reflection for the victims of the terrorist attack, with vigils held right across the country. Nicole Johnston reports.
Once a jealous swagman.
On a warm Sunday night in Sydney and around the country, Australians came together to reflect on the lives lost in the Bondi attack, including 10-year-old Matilda.
Come a waltz in, Matilda, with me.
People stood for 1 minute of silence, in shock and in grief.
How does it feel? Does it help with healing at all?
It's nice to see the wider community that have joined us. It's not just the Jewish community, there's a lot of Australians, like just general Australians that have come to be with us, and yeah, it helps with the healing in that way.
On the political front, New South Wales Parliament is being recalled today to debate new laws around banning terrorist symbols, removing face coverings during protest, and gun ownership. Senior counsel Brett Walker was the first independent national security legislation monitor in Australia. He says gun laws need to be strengthened.
The notion that any agency will always get priorities correct in the sense that nothing bad happens is, I'm afraid, unachievable. But I have to say that on any view of it, the question of the fitness of people to get gun licences probably is going to have to extend more widely. It can't probably be seen as simple as a driving licence.
As for demonstrations, the New South Wales government is moving to give police the power to restrict or ban protests during times of heightened tension. The move has been criticised by a number of civil liberty groups, including Amnesty International Australia, and by Dr. Nama Blattman, an executive member of the Jewish Council of Australia, which is a group of academics and lawyers who support Palestinian rights.
We are here today to say that the anti-protest laws being pushed through by the Minns government are not going to make us safer. These laws are born of political pressure, not a genuine consideration for the safety of our communities.
The federal opposition is calling for a royal commission into anti-Semitism and the Bondi terror attack and has released a draft terms of reference. However, the Albanese government has not gone that far, announcing instead a review by the Prime Minister's Department of Security Agencies, including ASIO. New South Wales Shadow Attorney General Julian Lisa says it's not enough.
And rather than looking at the root causes of what caused those gunmen to pick up those weapons in the first place, that only a royal commission will get to, he calls for another departmental review. This is the most shameful act in the history of our nation. Australia stands humiliated by the failure of leadership of this man.
Waltzing Matilda.
Back at the Bondi vigil, people sat on the grass overlooking the beach. Rabbi George Mordecai from Sydney's Emmanuel Synagogue says he's been moved by Sydney's response.
As we've been walking around the streets of Sydney with our kippahs, our caps on our heads, so many people, and I know Rabbi Kamens feels the same way, so many people have come up to us and say, we, you know, offering a consolation to us and offering condolences and saying we're with you. And it's been really, really, it's been really beautiful, actually.
Alleged Bondi gunman Naveed Akram is listed for mention in court today. He is facing 59 charges and is still in hospital. And in Sydney, the funeral for 27-year-old French-Israeli IT engineer Dan Al-Kayem is being held. He had been living in Australia for 1 year.
Nicole Johnston reporting. In a show of unity following the Bondi attack, tens of thousands of Australians have donated blood. But as the Christmas period begins, Australian Red Cross Lifeblood says the demand isn't going away, and they're urging people who can to keep donating. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
When they process the blood, they're going to separate it into three bags. Mm-hmm. So we'll end up with a bag of plasma, a bag of platelets, and a bag of red blood cells.
At Lifeblood's Sydney Town Hall Donor Centre, the donor floor is full. Many here have donated blood before, but were prompted to book another appointment after the terror attack in Bondi.
It's horrific to watch, but as a parent, you'll do anything you can. It's just such a simple thing, but it means so much to someone else, so easy to do.
I felt as an Australian, it was my duty to give back to the community.
I came in on Monday, but there was a really long queue and they said reschedule if you can because they're overwhelmed. So I rescheduled for today because we all know that, you know, after a big crisis event, blood is needed, but it's ongoing.
Jed Long moved back to Australia from Indonesia 24 hours before the attack.
I'm Jewish. I live in Bondi and I literally, we got back in on Saturday night. My wife was down there on Sunday and just kind of reminded me that I hadn't donated blood in a long time.
Gemma Falkenmeyer is a Red Cross Lifeblood spokesperson.
There was a very large emergency call out for blood donations from the hospitals. So they needed to have extra stocks in place for these victims coming in. We didn't know how much blood they were going to need, but it was probably going to be a lot. What that meant is on Monday morning, we had to move blood in from other states.
She says the response of Australians since has been extraordinary.
We've seen more than 50,000 Australians donate blood over the last week, and 120,000 people have got in contact with us to make an appointment. Kindness crashed our website, it crashed our call centre. The response was, you know, a huge tidal wave of people wanting to help out. We want to thank people for coming in and for their patience.
Among those who filled donation centres across the country were 14,000 new donors, and every drop is critical.
Someone who's got a major trauma and has damaged organs in various different areas, you know, some patients can need up to 100 different blood products.
Professor David Irving is from the School of Public Health at the University of Technology, Sydney, and is also a research director at Lifeblood.
Bullet wounds really sort of by definition end up with people bleeding quite extensively. So we were able to, within 24 hours of that terrible event, I think we delivered over 800 different blood components to the five different hospitals that were where all those patients were being delivered. So we don't know what's required, but it's essential to make sure that, you know, if a patient does need 100 units, for example, that they're there on hand.
And as the Christmas holiday period begins, Gemma Falkenmeyer is reminding Australians blood has a short shelf life.
There's a lot of patients in hospital needing blood at this time of year. There's a lot of new mums who need the blood on standby. There's a lot of children in children's hospitals who, they're a huge user of blood, and we don't want them to have to wait for their blood transfusions. There'll always be blood prioritised in accidents and emergencies, but we send out more than 7,000 bags of blood and plasma medications across the country every day, and every one of those patients is important.
She says donation centres will remain open, including many on Christmas Day, for anyone looking to give a gift to recipients who'll be in need.
Tanya Dendrinos and Alison Shaw. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today.
Rising power prices have been one of the biggest challenges for Australians juggling the cost of living this year. The federal government says it's trying to ease some of that pressure, today announcing a gas reservation scheme in a bid to drive down the cost of natural gas. Gas producers will have to reserve at least 15% of extracted gas for domestic use. For more, I spoke with political reporter Tom Crowley. Tom, take us through this announcement.
So Chris Bowen and Tim Ayres stood up in Parliament House. Look, it's something that we knew it was coming. We've been told that there would be an announcement of this kind before Christmas, and a few days before we now have it. It's really framed around the idea of the fact that Australia produces a lot of gas on its east coast, but a lot of it gets exported. And so we hear warnings about gas shortages, despite the fact that we are such a large gas exporter. And Chris Bowen today pointed out that Australians have an expectation that gas that is dug up here should be available for domestic use. Here's a little bit of him.
We've consulted on various models. We've consulted on various options, but we've decided to support as a preferred model for further consultation the simplest, easiest to implement, easiest to understand model of not allowing gas exports into the future unless the government is satisfied that domestic demand is catered for first. And we believe that that can be achieved by a national reservation of 15 to 25%, which we are consulting on from today.
So that simple model there that Chris Bowen is describing, a permit system. We're really talking about three large exporters in particular here. And so this would apply overall, 15 to 25% of the gas market must be reserved for domestic use in order for the exporters to be able to get their permits. And so that's the proposal. There'll be a period of consultation that will follow now where there will no doubt be a lot of discussion with these major players, with the industry. And it's 2027 when Chris Bowen says this will take effect, although it will apply to any contracts signed from today. So a little bit of a delay there, some more details to be worked out, but the first clear signal on which way the government plans to go.
Is the government likely to get much pushback on this plan?
So it is something that historically some within the gas industry have been resistant to. As time's gone on, I think that recognising that this is the way that politics is going, their advocacy has really turned more to certainty and to particular views on the design. So no doubt the details that haven't been finalised yet and that will be subject to consultation, they'll be hashed out a little bit. But broadly, I think that there is an understanding that this is something that there has been broad advocacy for across the political spectrum. Peter Dutton in the last election campaign made a proposal that was in a broadly similar policy terrain to this. David Pocock, the Independent MP, another one who's made similar calls. And so I think that the industry had some recognition that something like this was coming. On the other hand as well, there are energy users, gas users, large manufacturers who are particularly worried about looming shortages, who say that this needs to be done urgently. So that's another constituency that the government is really doing this on behalf of.
Tom Crowley there. Experts say the battle against AI cheating by students has gone too far. The ABC has revealed a number of cases where the tools used to detect cheating in high schools got it wrong. Some students got automatic zeros on assessment, others were forced to prove they didn't cheat. It's the latest development in the ongoing struggle with AI at schools and universities, and experts say it's time for a reset. For more, I spoke with Professor Kath Ellis, the Pro Vice Chancellor for Quality and Integrity at Western Sydney University. Professor Ellis, thanks for joining us. We know AI cheating is a big issue in schools and universities, but has the focus shifted too much towards catching students out?
Look, I think so. And I do think we've all drifted, as educators, we've drifted away from what we really need to be detecting here, which is whether learning has occurred or not. So I do think we need to reset, we need to rethink, and we need to sort of re-energise the way that we think about the work that we do as teachers and the way that we put responsibility onto measuring student learning back onto ourselves as teachers. So yes, I think we've really lost our way.
What do you think needs to change? Are tools like AI detectors the right approach?
Tools are tools, and they work best when they're handled by people to know how to use them and use them well. But they can be misused, and misuse of tools can create all sorts of damage and distress to people. So they are useful. They do their job, But you need to know what you're doing with them in order to interpret what they're telling you. And then you need to have appropriate conversations with students to make sure that you're gathering the right information about what needs to occur as a result of what they've found.
So how varied are the rules and approaches across the country? Are a lot of schools and educational institutions going it alone, trying to figure it out as they go?
That this is a very complex problem. We're experiencing similar complexities in the university sector. It's hardly surprising it's happening in the school sector as well. But what this looks like is a kind of trial and error, trying to figure it out as we go along with people who don't really know what sorts of conversations they should be having with each other in order to get to a good resolution. So I think that this trial and error approach is absolutely unfair. It's unfair on the students who are being interrogated in these quite unfair ways, but it's also unfair on the other students. It's unfair on the system itself and the learning that the sector needs to be warranting. So, yeah, I think we do absolutely need to reset the way we're talking about this.
So there are calls for coordinated national action to help students and teachers. What would that look like? Where does the buck stop with this?
I do think this needs a sector-wide conversation. We need to come to good decisions ourselves about what it is that we're trying to do here. And to me, it's that emphasis on going back to detecting whether or not learning has occurred rather than trying to detect whether or not cheating has occurred. And that's where I think we've really lost sight of what we're trying to do here. So I do think it needs a sector-wide approach. The standards are already there. It's about how do we make sure we're doing that well and with integrity in a world where generative AI exists.
So what would your message be to students starting university next year, coming into their HSC? Can they feel confident that the sector is working to fix this?
I think that the message I would give to students would be to talk to their teachers about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate and what's effective and ineffective use of generative AI, and make sure they keep having those conversations with their teachers until they feel confident that they know what is okay and what is not okay. Keep asking.
Professor Kath Ellis, Pro Vice Chancellor for Quality and Integrity at Western Sydney University. New research has revealed the majority of Victorian public school teachers can't afford to live near work. A University of New South Wales report commissioned by the Australian Education Union has found many jobs are in local government areas where teachers and education support workers can't afford to buy or rent. The union is warning the issue could make teacher shortages even worse, as Sasha Payne reports.
For graduate teacher Cooper Scott, getting his first job this year was a dream come true.
I see it as a career, not a job. I see it as something that I really want to be doing for nearly my entire life.
But he was quickly confronted with a problem, finding somewhere to live on a graduate wage. After accepting a humanities teaching position at Pakenham Secondary College in Melbourne's outer southeast, he and his partner Ashley, also a recent graduate, began house hunting. They eventually found a two-bedroom unit they were able to afford in a town called Druin, but it's left Cooper Scott travelling an almost 100-kilometre round trip each day.
It is taxing. It is very taxing for me, particularly after like a long day.
A new study from the University of New South Wales, commissioned by the Australian Education Union, has found affordable housing is out of reach for the majority of Victorian teachers and education support workers. Scott Ecott is a professor of education and one of the report's lead researchers.
So ensuring that we can have teachers that can live within commuting distance of where they're needed to work is an important part of public infrastructure, and making sure that our planning is set up in such a way that all of our schools can be staffed, just the same way we want to make sure all of our hospitals are staffed as well.
The report found for a family on a single teacher's income, 74% of local government areas in Victoria had a median house price that was seriously, severely, or impossibly unaffordable to buy. It found 43% of teaching positions were in an area where single graduate teachers couldn't even afford a one-bedroom rental. Victoria is already suffering from a chronic teacher shortage. Justin Mullally is the president of the union's Victorian branch.
It is the case that we have too many people who are travelling long, long distances every day simply because they can't live in reasonable proximity to the school in which they work.
In a statement, a Victorian government spokesperson told the ABC good faith negotiations for a new enterprise agreement are ongoing and that it looks forward to an agreement being finalised. The spokesperson also said the government had a portfolio of more than 200 homes available to teachers at reduced rent at more than 60 remote or hard-to-staff schools. The Education Union is calling for urgent initiatives, such as a new housing division within the Department of Education, rental subsidies, stamp duty exemptions for homes close to workplaces, and increased wages.
I think that any effort to attract and retain teachers is going to be seriously hindered if we can't have a situation where a teacher can reasonably afford a home.
Housing affordability is a growing problem for essential workers across the country. Anglicare's latest annual rental affordability snapshot, released in October, found a number of professions, including teachers, early childhood educators, nurses and cleaners, are being priced out of most rentals nationwide.
Sasha Payne. A digital marketing agency run by a former AFL star has reopened, despite owing more than $4 million to staff, suppliers and the tax office. Zib Digital went insolvent, leaving about a third of its workforce without a job or their entitlements. The company's actions are within the law, but questions are being asked about whether it's fair. Adelaide Miller reports.
In May this year, a business owned by former AFL star Chris Knights went insolvent, owing more than $4 million to the tax office. But just a few days later, the Australian and New Zealand-based marketing agency Zib Digital reopened under a new ABN. Here's Mr. Knights in a company-wide recording.
We have been planning this restructure for a little period, but fundamentally it was based on the performance of the business. We need the culture to improve.
While Zib reopened with no operating debt, it had cut its workforce significantly.
You know, it changes as good as a holiday, and the new facility is going to be built for purpose.
According to the administrator's report, the insolvent business owes $3.8 million to external suppliers, while staff are owed almost $450,000 in entitlements and the ATO almost $350,000.
Same name, same logo, same communications, emails, nothing changed.
That's one former employee who agreed to speak to the ABC under the condition of anonymity, and that's not his real voice. He wasn't made redundant, but was given 24 hours to sign a new contract with the new company, Zib Holdings.
The communications were not to let clients know business as usual. There was no difference to the previous business and the current business.
It's not the only Australian business to withhold staff entitlements. This month, the ATO said $1.1 billion in unpaid super had been returned to nearly a million individuals' super funds in 2024 to 2025, with $200 million raised by the ATO in penalties. Andrew Spring, a partner at restructuring firm Gersh Sutherland, said the insolvency process is a normal part of business to safeguard all involved.
Insolvency is there to protect both sides of the business relationship, debtors and creditors, and make sure that we are able to work inside the framework to create the greatest outcome from what is quite often very challenging sets of circumstances.
But not everyone who worked at Zib is protected. While most were able to apply to the Fair Entitlements Guarantee Scheme, also known as FEG, which is a taxpayer-funded financial assistance program, those on visas could not apply. Dutchwoman Renee is being played by an actor.
I think it's the way that it's been done, where it's, we don't have any money, but yet they've moved down the road.
She is owed nearly $20,000 in unpaid entitlements, but won't receive them under the FEG scheme because she is on a visa. Zib's actions are within the law, but have raised questions about the legislation that allows restructured insolvent companies to rise again with the same assets, but without the debts of the previous entity, and usually with fewer staff. Scott Cohen, Assistant National Secretary of the Australian Services Union, called the practice legal trickery.
We really need to look at reforming the laws in this area. Workers are definitely, you know, at the bottom of the pile when it comes to a list of priority creditors in these situations, and they're really left powerless in terms of what they can do, in terms of what legal rights that they have.
In a statement to the ABC, Mr. Knight said he has been navigating an extremely challenging economic period and that his industry has had to make difficult redundancies.
Adelaide Miller reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Stephanie Smale.